Offside with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes! Caught offside from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. It is Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
How are you, man?
Doing well. First week in the books. You're back, and you're back with a haircut.
I can't. Well, at least you noticed this time.
I mean, it's hard not to notice this one.
What's wrong with it?
Who said anything was wrong with it?
It's a bit tight.
Don't project your own insecurities on things that I'm saying.
It's a Portland do. Got it in Portland.
You were in Portland. I'm very excited to hear all about your trip. You went to a Timbers game out at Providence Park.
Well, you say out at, as if you have to travel out of the city to get to it. It's wonderful. It's fantastic. Downtown stadium, renovated baseball ground. It's what they've built there is absolutely great.
Yeah.
And it was a fairly good game too.
Yeah. We'll talk about it a little bit later on in the podcast. We actually have a lot to talk about. I have a feeling this is going to be a long one. We've got a La Liga preview.
Brevity is not our watchword.
No, it's really not. Lots in what to watch for. The Champions League had some pretty shocking results today, which we'll have to mention at some point. We've got, of course, the Premier League Week 1 in the books that we're going to cover. I guess we'll kind of start there, but before we really dive into that, I know we've been kind of dancing around this and hinting at it for a while now, but we have just kind of been sitting here with this Christian Pulisic jersey waiting to give it away.
The good people from classicfootballshirts.co.uk, which is a brilliant website everyone should visit, and I buy a lot of jerseys there. They have kindly given us a really nice 17-18 Pulisic jersey that we can hold on to when he starts on the bench.
Don't be like that.
Well, we'll get to that.
People are very, very upset about that. So here's what we're going to do. We're finally ready to give this away to all you fine people. Not all of you. One of you fine people. Here's how it's going to work. Tweet or Instagram us when you believe Christian Pulisic will score his first league goal. All right? No Champions League, no League Cup, no FA Cup, no UEFA Super Cup. Just the EPL, the English Premier League. We need the game that you think it'll happen. So say who the opponent will be. And then we need the minute in which you think it'll occur. You can only be eligible if you hashtag your post with hashtag caught offside Pulisic. We need that hashtag so we can keep track of all the entries. You can also only be eligible to win if you select the correct game. By that, I mean this. Let's say, so Chelsea plays Leicester City this weekend. Let's say he doesn't score against Leicester, but then in Chelsea's next game, he scores in the first minute. And you had said, oh, he'll score versus Leicester in the 90th. Just because you were close, technically you only have missed by 1 minute, but you're still not eligible to win. You have to have select from within the actual game when the goal is scored. If by some chance two people have the same game and the same minute, which is highly unlikely, but still, the tiebreaker will be whoever submitted theirs first on Twitter or Instagram. Also, let's say Pulisic scores in the fourth minute of a game and somebody said the third and somebody else said the fifth. We will be giving it to the person who had the fourth minute. Price is Right rules, closes without going over. All right. If he winds up scoring in a game that no one picked, then we'll just reset. We'll wipe the slate entirely clean, and we'll play again for when he'll score his second goal.
Does that
make sense?
That made sense. That hashtag is caught offside Pulisic. We're going to need that in all entries for them to be rubber stamped.
Yeah. So when you say the game, make sure you make it clear if it's like at Stamford Bridge or if it's an away game for Chelsea. Just make it as clear as possible. You can find us on Twitter at CO Soccer Pod. Or on Instagram, caught offside ESPN. And like we said, hashtag caught offside Pulisic. It's a beautiful jersey. I have kind of been hoping secretly that you just like forgot that we had it so I could maybe just take it home and wear it around, but that would be wrong.
No, that would be very wrong. And classicfootballshirts.co.uk would be on to me and they would ask me deep and probing questions.
Have they been asking about this?
They gave it to us and they said, well, whenever you want to give it away, just let us know.
Okay.
So they are really, really great people. And that website is how you lose hours at work.
So start sending your tweets with your predictions. Hopefully it happens. I would like for it to happen soon because I'm a Christian Pulisic fan, as you all know. And let's go right into that now and talk about what was a pretty unfortunate debut for Christian's Chelsea as they lose to Manchester United 4-0 at Old Trafford. I guess while we're talking about Pulisic, let's just start with that right out of the gate because I will say this. Obviously, I'm aware of what American fans think of him. You know, I love him I know I talk all the time about how American fans treat him like he's their son abroad, and we want to make sure that he's doing okay. And I say that jokingly.
But it is paternalistic.
I think I came to find out over the weekend that there is a lot more truth to that than I maybe ever even actually realized. People were angry to a point that I wasn't necessarily expecting when his name did not appear in the starting lineup.
It was incredible, and I think I missed the first 15-20 minutes of it fielding people's upset on our Twitter feed. You know, stuff to the point where they were saying, well, Frank Lampard clearly hates him. You know, this level of but sadness. One guy telling me he was so sad, he was just really upset. Another guy who said he was frustrated. And I understand all these feelings because this doesn't compare to anything we've ever had before. We've never had a player transferred for that amount of money. We've never had him in the most watched league in the world. We've had players there, but they've come via MLS or via some other way. Or we've had Landon Donovan, who had just a brief stay there in his mid-20s. So this was a huge big deal to have Pulisic in this position.
But I mean, look, Clint Dempsey made a big move to Tottenham. I don't remember, like, there were plenty of games he didn't start. I don't remember nearly this kind of outrage.
Oh no, this is different. This is the great white hope of American soccer. The one guy we can say we have him. Well, you don't have anybody like, technically, well, we do. We have him. This is our guy. When I was on a radio show 5 years ago, a guy said to me, well, you know, this was before Pulisic's debut. Mike Lupica, who writes for the Daily News, said, well, we're bound to have somebody in a city who will be our Messi, hidden away in some rural part or in some city. And that's why people are so invested in this kid. The other side to it is, though, Frank Lampard owes Christian Pulisic nothing. Frank Lampard didn't sign Christian Pulisic. Maurizio Sarri barely signed Christian Pulisic. Christian Pulisic came in to this team having to prove himself. Mason Mount is ahead of him in that sense. Now, is Mason Mount a better footballer than Christian Pulisic? I would say no. Is he more experienced? Certainly not. Christian Pulisic has X amount of Champions League games under his belt already, and he's only 20. But Mason Mount played last season for Derby under the eye of Frank Lampard at Old Trafford in a game that they won and played very well in. He has the trust of the manager. He was de facto his first signing, making sure he was committed to play at Chelsea for the foreseeable. He went with what he knew. It was maybe, I don't think it was a mistake. Mason Mount was okay in touches, as was Pedro and everybody else.
Yeah.
I don't think, if he had started Pulisic, I would have been fine with it. If he brought him in after an hour or so, it made sense too. I think we all got a bit caught up in it, and I understand it, but we need probably to be a little more calm.
Yeah, I mean, look, ultimately, I was disappointed. I was hoping to see him for 90 minutes, and I was kind of thinking that would be the case. He had a preseason with them. He's not like a guy who was just brought in on deadline day that needs time to get acclimated to the club. Like, it felt like he should be ready to go. I think that's maybe why there's more disappointment with this than what a lot of people thought. Like,
yeah, I understand.
He doesn't need to. Like, people are saying, oh, well, he's got to get used to, like, what it's like in the Premier League. Maybe that's true, but he's not coming from MLS. Like you said, he's coming from Borussia Dortmund.
He started a knockout game in the Champions League against Real Madrid. You know,
he's not some, like, wide-eyed, starry-eyed kid who just, like, fell into this and can't even believe what's going on around him and needs time to get settled. Like, he's ready to go. I'm sure he could play right away. But by the same token, it doesn't mean that Frank Lampard hates him.
No.
I think that is a massive overreaction. It doesn't mean that this is going to be permanently what his role is for Chelsea.
But you've got to say, the trust issue is a huge thing. He spent the last 15, 18 months with Mason Mount. So he's going to go on that side. And Pedro is an experienced international. He's not going to drop him either. So he went with what he knew for this game, and it didn't work out anyway. And when Pulisic came in, he didn't make a difference, not because the tide had turned, partly, but also, when he came in, Mount was still on the field, and there was an abundance of attackers. And if you look at a part of that game, there was a moment, apart from the first slaloming run he went on, but which Pogba cynically took him out of, and it probably took him a few seconds to recover, because he caught him right on the hip bone with that tackle. But apart from that, most of the time, Pulisic wasn't drifting in off the left or coming in off the right. He was kind of in this nether zone in the centre, trying to find space, trying to pick pockets of space. He set up one shot that was well parried by De Gea. But look, it was a debut, guys.
And I think we should all be okay. Nicolas Pepe didn't start at the weekend for Arsenal either. Right. You know, this happens. It is not a reflection on anything. We need to let this play out. I understand your frustrations, but let's let it play out.
Yeah, totally agree. Let's talk a little bit more about the game. I mean, because look, ultimately, when you get two top six sides playing against each other, and the scoreline is such, decided by four goals, a 4-0 thrashing one over the other, you want to draw some conclusions from that. I feel like we're maybe a little bit more hesitant to do it only because it's the first week of the season. But I would say, like, that's a significant enough final score where if you want to, if you want to pull some thoughts from it, I think you're well within your rights to do that. Like, I don't know. I would say that it probably was not as bad for Chelsea as what the scoreline indicates. I know that I don't know how much solace they'll take in that because 4-0 is what it is. But like, the first half felt fairly even to me.
They hit the
post twice. I didn't think Manchester United were outstanding. I thought United were a lot better in the second half, and Chelsea's defense just completely fell apart. But you do feel like some of that is down to players who may not have been there. Like, I think Rudiger will make a difference for Chelsea. I don't think that guys like Azpilicueta or Kurt Zouma will be that bad consistently as they were in the second half. So
I think
it's not totally sky is falling after one game.
No, I think if Frank Lampard had a decision to make, he said prior to the game Kante wasn't ready to go, that he wasn't match fit. So it wasn't an injury issue, it was match fitness. I think if he had to do it again, he may have started him, he may have reconfigured that midfield a little bit differently. And okay, if he's gassed after an hour, what at least you've, you know, got through that period. The early goal didn't, the goal against the run of play did not help things either. Also, it's not like United were dominant in midfield or kept the ball. Like, Chelsea had more of the ball. This was an interesting one from Matt Stead. He pointed out Jorginho and Kovacic made more passes, 119, than Pogba, McTominay and Pereira combined. They had less than 100, they had 98. They rivaled them for combined tackles and interceptions, 5-7. That's two players against the United's three, and completed more dribbles, 5-1. But what United were good at, Andrew, was broken play. So there was a couple of moments in the first half where Pogba got on the ball and he looks up the field and he has to go square and he pulls out his hands like, where's the movement? What's going on? And I'm like, that's not much of a change from last season. But what was interesting was in broken play in the second half, you look at how they attack the spaces. When they won the ball back from Chelsea, Chelsea's transition to defence was way off. Jose Mourinho was on Sky Sports and what was interesting was they were talking about, oh, look at Chelsea coming to Old Trafford and playing so open. Look at Norwich going to Anfield. Look at Villa going to Spurs. And Mourinho had a different take on it, and it was quite interesting to hear.
One thing is the tactical system, another thing are principles of play. And there are principles of play that they have to be permanent. And one of them, and if, let's laugh a little bit, when you remember your Uncle Rafa on the touchline, he was always doing this. Right? What Rafa wants to do when says to the pitch, he was always this. Well, compact. And there was moments where we were looking at the game from this position here, and Chelsea without the ball had a block of six and other four. Tammy Abraham was staying up, Barclay was staying up, Mount was staying up, Pedro was staying up. Nowadays, you look to the good teams, and all the good teams, they defend compact. Higher block, lower block. The lower block is more defensive. The higher block is more offensive, is more aggressive, but always in a block. So there are principles of play that doesn't have to do with the system you play. It's just a basic principle. You have to defend compact.
The second goal was a classic example of that, and it was the killer. Came from Tammy Abraham has the ball, Maguire nips in, pokes it away, United break into acres of space. Most Chelsea players, like Mourinho said, were high up the field. They're chasing the game. He also brought on a ton of attackers, which unbalanced the side. And the same with the third goal. Long ball over the top between the defenders, and there's acres of space for Rashford. Paul Pogba was getting the plaudits for that pass. It's a great pass. Pogba can do that in his sleep. He will destroy you. Ditto with the fourth goal. All that space. Chelsea's defensive transition has to be better.
Yeah, don't really have too much else to say about that. We'll move on now. Manchester City and Liverpool really did nothing, I would say, in the first games for them to change our mind about what this league is going to look like. this season. I know that, you know, the opponents are what they were. West Ham may be okay, but, you know, all in all, this is what we've come to expect from Liverpool and Manchester City. I almost think that these are the kinds of things that happened last year that led you to kind of believe that the title race was almost boring.
Yeah, there was a general groan after full time, and it wasn't just from the London Stadium and West Ham fans. There was a lot of people saying, is this what it's going to be like for the rest of the season? I don't believe it will be. I predict Liverpool will have some fall off, but you watch the weekend, most of the teams they're going to come up against, they're going to deal with and deal with them handily.
It's unbelievably how quickly the Adrian acquisition for Liverpool matters.
Has there ever been a substitute goalkeeper get a reception like that coming onto the field?
Yeah.
It's like,
why is he? Are they just happy that they have someone who isn't Mignolet or Karius? Like, is that all this is?
They're supporting this guy because they know he's coming in and he needs to be big. He needs to be good.
You know, it is interesting though, because part of me, you see that Alisson gets hurt, and obviously that's bad. We know how good of a player he is, how good of a goalkeeper he is. But, you know, Liverpool are going to score a lot of goals, and you sometimes wonder, like, just how important is he? I happen to think the margins between them and Manchester City are so, they're just so small.
Right.
And so who knows what sort of, you know, Alisson versus Napoli save, you know, he's capable of making that maybe, while still a good keeper, Adrian maybe isn't going to make that
correct
save. Like, the margins are small enough between City and Liverpool where that stuff could matter.
I absolutely agree with you. And is Adrian's kicking as good as Alisson's? I actually can't remember. When Adrian played in goal for West Ham was playing out from the back en vogue. I don't remember.
Maybe not for them.
No, but I remember Adrian being a good, solid keeper for West Ham. A couple of mistakes and he was done. So I'm happy to have him on board. It was a really prescient signing because as much as I love my fellow Irishman, Kevin Kelleher is not ready for this. I really don't think he is.
No, this turned out to be just like the perfect signing at the absolute perfect time. I don't think anyone could have predicted or wanted this to happen. I mean, he's only there in case Alisson gets hurt, which unfortunately has already happened. Oh, supposed to miss what? Up to maybe 4 weeks or so?
Yes. So that means
not crippling, but still important.
Kind of good he misses the international break.
The early international break. Look, I don't. Do we want to do this? Do we want to talk about VAR at all? Because
I've broken down into small points.
So I have here because I was ready to just tee off. I got so angry. I couldn't believe how angry I got over the weekend.
Did you see how
I had to be talked down by myself?
In elections in England, there's the thing called the swingometer. And it shows the swing between Labour and Tory from the last election.
Yeah.
Right?
I want to talk about that. Not the Tory and Labour stuff, but the analogy that you're making.
This swingometer has swung towards JJ.
Yeah, the swingometer can go and do stuff.
Can I just make my points?
And sure, as long as you promise to let me speak, because I've written, I had to write my thoughts down because I was so...
You were
so
angry, you texted me.
Yeah. I'll say your piece first.
All right, okay. I don't like the current offside wording. I don't think VAR should be used for anything other than the most howling, glaring mistakes by the ref. VAR changes the experience of football for players and for viewers. Fan.
I love when you do that smugly. Here's my deal, JJ. I saw your tweets over the weekend from the show account. I saw you retweeting everyone who agrees with you. It created a very nice little JJ echo chamber. I'll tell you what, I was damn close to blocking our own account. I was getting so annoyed with seeing this. I don't know, is this the tact that I should take now? Because I feel like you keep doing this. You've created the echo chamber of anti-VAR, and I've been silent about it. So do I need to remind people now? Like, should I go through the litany of people who we respect that support this thing, like Gary Lineker and Gab Marcotti and Craig Burley and Steve Nicol and just like on and on?
Rafa Honigstein, Robbie Savage.
We adore him. I mean, like, for every one of your Rory Smith articles, should I come out with like 15 or 100 of these guys who support it? Does that sound like fun to people?
Sure.
Here's the problem.
Sure.
Here's what set me off, JJ. I had someone tweet at me that I had stopped arguing with you about VAR because I knew it was no longer defendable.
Oh, that's not true.
Nope. Wrong. Wrong. I was good with VAR when they first instituted it, and I'm good with it now. You want me to spike the ball? make a spectacle with each of its successes? Or better yet, how about the moments like in the Africa Cup of Nations when Ghana was basically screwed out of their round of 16 match because of the absence of VAR, which didn't kick in until the quarterfinals? But yeah, all the time spent training for players and the emotion spent from fans, it's not as important as the 20 seconds it takes for a review. And before you cut me off to say that that's not true, I am reading directly from a Sky Sports study done last year regarding the amount of time it takes to review a play. The median time taken for all incidents is 20 seconds, and the majority of checks take place while play continues or during, quote, normal stoppages like goal celebrations or when the ball is out of play. I've stopped arguing all this because I'm of the belief that having this debate week after week is boring, not because I'm ducking and hiding from anyone. And I'll be honest, JJ, I'll be honest. It's hard to argue with this with you in particular, because you come at this from the perspective where you were fine with Thierry Henry's handball preventing Ireland from qualifying for World Cup. To me, that's not reasonable. It's hard to have a conversation about it with somebody who's coming at it from that angle. I get why there's frustration with it. Change always brings about frustration, but exaggerating its flaws serves no purpose other than just trying to win an argument, which is what I believe you are doing. There were roughly 70 decisions that VAR looked at over the weekend. I watched games all weekend long, and with only a couple exceptions, you barely even knew it was being used. Saying that it was obtrusive is disingenuous. Is there going to be a goal or two each week that you deem controversial because of VAR's ruling? I'm sure there will be. But guess what? That's no different than the way things were before VAR, except now, at least those controversial goals all end up the same way with the correct ruling. So is it even fair to refer to that as being a thing that's controversial? So if the philosophical argument here is contentment with the wrong call versus consistent ability to get the right one, I'm going to stay entrenched on my side, you're going to stay entrenched on yours, and we move on, hopefully talking more about the game than the officiating. So that's for everyone out there who felt like the person that sent me that tweet saying that I had stopped arguing it because I couldn't defend it anymore. That's for all of you who believe that. I still believe in it, and I still believe that it's working.
You were fine with a delay for that.
Yeah.
I'm holding up the picture of the elbow incident, the shoulder incident, the whatever incident from West Ham and City. You're fine with that. That's okay.
I don't mind.
That's fine. Okay, let's move on.
Okay. Let's see. Tottenham come back and beat Aston Villa 3-1. I want to play something for you from Steve Nicol. It's about Christian Eriksen. And Steve basically, as you'll hear, says that Tottenham need Eriksen.
It's not until somebody's not there that it becomes glaringly obvious.
Yep, there it is.
How important they are. Mm. And if you want an example, this is it. This is the best example ever. A team that had no chance of scoring. All they did were putting balls in the box. Tyrone Mears, he must have a sore head tonight, the amount of balls he headed away. Mm-hmm. So Tottenham really didn't have any sort of real idea how to break this team down until Eriksen stepped on the field. And then all of a sudden, you see somebody picking up balls in little holes, playing little passes in behind. Aston Villa then became a completely different animal, totally lost control defensively, and they end up losing 3-1, which nobody saw after, 55 minutes?
This is what we call narrative building.
Yeah, is that strictly true?
No.
And I thought Ndombele was pretty great.
Well, I'll talk about him in a sec, but I want to stick with Eriksen for a moment here. People who listen to this podcast for a while know that I love Christian Eriksen. I think he's a tremendous player. But this idea that Tottenham were never going to score until he stepped out there, I mean, Lucas Moura missed a free header from 6 yards out. Harry Kane missed a free header from about 3 yards out. Moussa Sissoko had an opportunity in front of net, like no one near him, 3 yards from goal, and he just shanked it completely wide. Aston Villa defended for their lives. Tyrone Mings was sensational. But this idea that Tottenham just like are like some pathetic, crippled unit that can't perform if Eriksen's not out there. Yeah, he's great. He's really important. Tottenham have new players. They're going to have to work these guys in, and it might take some time. But, like, I see the narrative building here that if Eriksen goes, then, like, people are going to pounce on, well, Daniel Levy wouldn't open up his pockets to give Eriksen what he deserved. And so whatever happens now, like, this is what Tottenham deserve. First of all, let's see if any of that happens. But I'm just not there with the if Eriksen doesn't play, Tottenham can't. They're like a relegation candidate. Like for Steve Nicol to be saying they were never going to score until he stepped. That's just like I don't mean to. Well, whatever. I'll say it. Like, did he watch the game?
Yeah.
Like, that's just not true. That's just not true.
No, and so, and also it should be, you know, pointed out that Villa didn't help themselves. Scoring early on, they, as I thought they played quite well. They created another chance after they went 1-0 up. McGinn slided a nice ball through, but generally they fell further and further back. Is what happens to teams when they're away from home, even the better sides.
Yeah.
Like, and, you know, Jack Grealish giving away the ball on the edge of the box was directly responsible for one of the goals. That wasn't an Eriksen.
No, Lamella came, tracked him down, took it away, then an unlucky bounce now, off Mings, and it goes to Kane, who scores.
Now, my football pensions is for that kind of Eriksen player, you know, that kind of creative.
Yeah, I hope it doesn't sound like I'm being pitted against him, but I desperately want him to stay.
I don't think it's fair to just to talk about the game in that context. Like, Tottenham were knocking on the door for so long, and then the gates opened and they scored plenty.
Yeah,
so.
They are in a terribly difficult position with Eriksen. I honestly don't like saying this. I hate falling back on I don't know. I don't know what they do here with him. If he's not willing to sign a new contract with them, do they have no? And Real Madrid don't appear to be interested.
No.
So what are they supposed to do? Do they have to just give him away now just to like get something back before the European transfer window closes? Or do they take their chances and just say, okay, well,
I think Levy will take his chances with this one.
What do you offer him? Like, they're talking about doubling his wages. But if he's not going to sign that, like, what is he just going to hold them hostage until they have to pay him like a Gareth Bale amount of money? I don't know that you can do that.
You know,
he's good, but he's not their best player.
I don't know. I think maybe Eriksen should look at the landscape of things and realize the position he's in. If I'm him, I'm staying put.
I agree. I don't know. Look, I can't get in his head. I don't know why he's wants to leave so badly. It seems like a good situation.
I don't see a fit out there for him as good as Spurs right now. And I mean, he makes that team better, I do think. He also fits into that. Like, he's a starter for me. I can configure that midfield. I can configure that attack in a way which makes Spurs really, really good. And he can win with Spurs, I think, will be my other point. And it was interesting listening to Rory Smith, who believes Spurs can finish second this season. Strongly believes that. And I think Eriksen should think
maybe
about that.
I don't know. That's tough to say.
I don't know. Like, that team has got significant improvements should these players pan out.
Absolutely. Yeah, we haven't even been on doing a podcast since deadline day when they made these acquisitions of Dombele and Lo Celso.
Well, they had Dombele and Lo Celso.
Well, yeah, we talked about
Dombele,
yeah.
I meant
Sessegnon.
Yeah, Sessegnon. Well, we'll see how Sessegnon works out.
He's hurt right now. It's going to take a while for him. I don't think he's really a major part of their plans, at least for the first half
anyway,
of the season.
That's off the point. I think if I'm Eriksen, I think you're in a good spot. The grass isn't always greener on the other side, you know?
And Dombele scored his goal, and I would say he was fine until that moment.
I thought he was good.
And then, yeah, he was fine. And then he scored his goal, and JJ, it was just like a confidence switch just like flicked on, and all of a sudden I couldn't take my eyes off him. He was unbelievable. So if that's the player that they're going to be getting now, the guy that they got from the moment he scored until the end of the game, oh my God, I thought he was tremendous. And at 22 years old, a buddy of mine texted me and he's like, wow, that was some debut for Ndombele. And I wrote back, I was like, is it bad that I'm already worried about him going to Real Madrid?
By the way, just to finish up, this, Mourinho, when he was on Sky, he just betrayed himself to be Andrew Gundling. I'm just going to say this quickly because we have to get on.
Yeah.
I could believe it. He showed the paranoia that informs his football. He said, the best teams are always thinking about, in a position, what happens when we lose the ball. That's you in life. What's happened when the worst case scenario? You know the way he plays so restricted and constricted and his teams aren't attacking because they're always afraid of what happens when the ball is surrendered? That is your approach to life. I could give you a bar of gold right now and you'd be like, oh, it's good, but if I bring it home, I'll put it on a shelf. It could fall off the shelf, crack me on the head and kill me. That is, you are kindred spirit with Jose.
There is some truth to that. Let's see. Arsenal struggle to get past Newcastle, but they do get past Newcastle 1-0. If we want to talk about lineup decisions made by Frank Lampard and Chelsea, I thought Unai Emery's were a little bit more head-scratching. Like, Nicolas Pepe not being in the starting lineup, okay. Like, maybe I would have started him, but Emery knows his guys better than I do and whether or not he's ready. But like, what is, when are Lacazette and Aubameyang just going to consistently play alongside one another?
Well, to play Aubameyang up front in his own and with a three in behind of Nelson, Willock, and Mkhitaryan, I would never have put that three together, but he knows his team, he knows his squad. Yeah,
but like, why is Lucas Torreira not playing?
Last season, I said Torreira would start immediately for me. He played Guendouzi in the centre of the park. Could you not play Torreira and Guendouzi together in the two there if you wanted to play a 4-2-3-1 like he appeared to? Okay, fine. I would always start Lacazette. Lacazette is the fall guy whenever he tweaks this formation. He is always the guy that misses out. Andrew, he didn't come off the bench.
Yeah, I don't exactly get it. Also, we haven't had a chance to talk about the David Luiz signing. First of all, it's going to really be a problem when him and Guendouzi are out on the field at the same time.
Because of the Sideshow Bob haircut.
Yeah, and like I feel like their build is almost similar. It's just going to be hard to identify. I swear I'm not just being anti-Arsenal guy, but part of me felt like the David Luiz signing by Arsenal, it's one of those things we do where we overinflate somebody's value just because they've changed teams. Like David Luiz on Chelsea was never a player that we really complimented for being a great defender. But because Arsenal are so desperate and he goes there now, it's a good signing. Well, if he's not that good on Chelsea as a defender, we suddenly are going to change our tune for him at Arsenal. Like, I get Arsenal had to make a move at central defense because they're so desperate there. But I'm sorry, I don't see him coming in and say, oh, problem's fixed.
No,
central defenses should be fine now. Maybe it's a small improvement, but I don't know.
I guess maybe with the experience he has there, and maybe if he's matched up with Chambers or Socrates, that they can find a formula that works. And also, again, what happens in front is important. I mean, if it's Xhaka and Guendouzi in front of him with maybe Torreira, maybe he changes formation, maybe when Luis starts, Torreira comes in. You don't know what he's going to pair, how he's going to make that look.
I have no idea what their preferred 11 is.
I don't know, but all I know is, I would like, if I'm an Arsenal fan, I'd like at some point to know what that would look like.
I totally agree.
But I don't want to criticize them because the goal they scored was a brilliant finish from Aubameyang. I actually think they've got a really good attack.
They definitely do.
My major thing is the defense strong enough? And also, can you please settle on playing all these players together?
Here's Craig Burley. He thinks somewhat highly of Arsenal as well.
Now, it's an Arsenal side that is going to creak at times this year, so they're going to need goals. But also an Arsenal side that when everybody's fit, they've got a lot of attacking players. Don't forget, Kolasinac and Ozil didn't travel either. Saw them against Bayern in the ICC. They've got some very good youngsters coming through, and I think we're seeing Unai Emery. He's not scared to blood those youngsters in big games. So that's good for them going forward. But most importantly, clean sheet, good away win, 3 points, get the new signings up to speed, and then move on from there. Arsenal, on the day this year, are going to be a difficult team to beat.
Absolutely believe that. I totally believe that. And, you know, there's Tierney to come into that team yet as well. Maitland-Niles played well in that, in stealing the ball away and setting up the goal. Yeah, I mean, I picked them to be the surprise casualty but that was before a lot of, two signings were made since we did that podcast. I don't know. I still stick with it. They are going to have rough days. They definitely will. I hope just that the manager doesn't shoot himself in the foot by being too much of a Ranieri 2.0 tinkerman. Yeah.
By the way, something that Craig mentioned in there, Ozil and Kolasinac, what exactly is going on here?
We don't know. There's a lot of speculation.
Apparently, they're now out indefinitely.
But what does indefinitely mean? I mean, the club have basically said we don't know when they'll be back. So I guess that's that's indefinitely. But what is going on in terms of? There's wild rumors going around,
which we're not really going to toil in.
No, we're not going to toil in because we don't know the truth. But I really feel for them and their families.
Yeah, this is a really, really bizarre, unfortunate situation. One other thing to get to, Newcastle.
Yeah.
Their fans had planned a boycott for this game. It was noticeable. I think they said on the broadcast there were probably about 5,000 empty seats.
Which is huge for a ground that is never not full.
And there were definitely moments in the game where there was no atmosphere. Just lulls. It wasn't a great game to begin with, but just like atmospheric lulls that were noticeable on television. That club is just, I don't know, I feel for their fan base because they're just in such a weird place right now.
Yeah, and the fans that want rid of Bruce have got some red meat. Craig Hope of the Daily Mail wrote this. It was a pretty good article, an article that Steve Bruce's son challenged on Twitter, then deleted his tweets because there really wasn't much grounds to challenge it. Craig wrote, "It did not look good for Newcastle boss Steve Bruce screaming, 'What the f*** is happening?' towards his backroom team as the left wing back he had just brought in charged around the centre of midfield. Eventually, after 2 minutes of confusion and much enthusiastic running from substitute Jethro Williams, a livid Bruce got his message onto the field. Williams switched to his natural position and Matt Ritchie, a left-sided midfielder, came infield to fill the role left by Jonjo Shelvey. Just 2 minutes later, and Williams, probably worn out from his midfield cameo, was caught in his heels and Ainsley Maitland-Niles stole the ball before breaking forward to set up Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang for the game's only goal. It was just a lack of communication with him," said Bruce about the substitution. Can't happen.
No.
It can't happen. And he got absolutely had his pocket picked by Maitland-Niles. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a bit of a mess.
I'll tell you what, we'll take a very quick break. We still have a lot to do, JJ. There's a little bit of Champions League that happened today that bears mentioning. We're going to preview La Liga for you. We got a little mailbag. There's a lot going on here. Don't go anywhere.
Morris again, cutting back inside. Sterling! Brilliant! Wonderful, crisp finish from Sterling.
Oh, back now on Caught Offside, a nice opening day hat trick for Raheem Sterling. What a player he is.
Yes, and I've really been enjoying those Factory Records jerseys, therefore we had to have new order there. Just had to happen. Can I do something really, really quickly?
Yeah.
Couple of points. That's 33 and 50 for Aubameyang. That's really, really good. And if Arsenal were better, we'd be talking about him alongside the starts that players like Thierry Henry made and Ian Wright. Brace from Ashley Barnes. 3-0 win for Burnley at Turf Moor. Brilliant point for Sheffield United. Billy Sharp scoring. Graham Potter off to a flyer with BHAFC.
I would never say that.
Just some of those things right. That happened the weekend. We were confounded. Our predictions were confounded a little bit on this earliest of days.
Oh my God. First of all, we don't make any conclusions until after the third week.
That's right.
We wouldn't even consider making conclusions after week one. Come on, people.
Crazy.
Let's see, JJ. Let's look at La Liga. I think it's time. It begins on Friday. Friday games will be happening. Monday games, however, will not. I think that was the thing that was up in the air with La Liga coming into the season. A couple questions here to kind of get you ready for the start of the league. It's been, 8 of the last 11 titles have been won by Barcelona domestically. They've now won 26 all-time in the top flight in Spain. Is there any reason to think that this isn't going to just be another dominant Barcelona season?
No, there really isn't. And when you consider the players they've added to the midfield, De Jong is just going to be... I mean, he's the highest... Is there anybody of his in his age group that's thought of more highly right now? He's just absolutely fantastic. And we've seen him last season at Ajax. What a coup for Barcelona to be able to get him. He slots into that team. He's a starter straight away. Griezmann, Suarez, Messi up front. Busquets, Rakitic in the midfield alongside De Jong. Longley, Piqué. You could have Sergi Roberto on one side, Alba on the other. Ter Stegen in goal. Not that much has changed for me, Andrew. That is still the dominant team in La Liga.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it's interesting because if it doesn't go... You wonder what constitutes a good season for Barcelona. Do they have to get back to at least the Champions League final?
Messi, and I don't mean to cut across you. Messi last season, when they all got together before the start of La Liga, they said, we know the domestic championship's important, but they felt confident. They said that big ears was their target. Right. It had been too long since 2015.
Too long?
I know.
3 years.
But they wanted to reassert dominance. They felt that they hadn't done themselves justice in Europe in the last few seasons. What happened at Anfield was a seismic blow to that, and there will be no stone unturned. Hence why they went out and got De Jong. Hence why they paid what they paid for Griezmann.
The thing is, too, it's not just what happened at Anfield. It's the fact that it happened a year before also in Rome. If your ambition is to win that trophy, which it rightfully should be for Barcelona, they were probably the favorite both of those years. Like blowing leads like that, you just expect more from a veteran-laden team, which is why Ray Hudson, of BN Sport talks about this. He says this season is now on Ernesto Valverde.
The much derided coach was implicit, let's be honest, in the disasters of Roma and Anfield's second leg catastrophes. Unable to construct a lineup to defend 3-0 leads or score a single away goal that would have secured a Champions League final and likely, probably winners. He should have learned, but he did not. This is it for Ernesto Valverde, make no mistake. 2 consecutive league crowns won while riding a unicycle won't and doesn't cut it. In Messi, he has Excalibur, the greatest footballer to ever play the game. But if this season is not a big success, it'll be Valverde who is put to the sword.
Well, I mean, Ray is right, but Roma or Anfield aside, you know, it always falls on the manager. That's just the way it works. Yeah. It's amazing.
Well, sometimes it falls on the face of a team, which is Messi. And that's just...
You couldn't have watched that game at Anfield and come away with that conclusion.
Of course.
I will just say this, that it's amazing. We're talking about Barcelona. We've answered all our questions here. Barcelona's focus will be the Champions League, but they'll still be the best team in Spain.
Yeah. So along those lines then, who do you view, if we're going to say that there is a challenge to Barcelona's reign over La Liga, who poses the greater challenge? Is it Real Madrid or is it Atletico Madrid or is it somebody that I'm not mentioning?
Well, it's probably not. It's funny because Atleti finished second last season without being a threat to Barcelona. And now this season, can we expect them to really push a rejuvenated Barcelona closer? The preseason buzz has been around Joao Felix and he is most definitely a talented young man who had a very good preseason. But let's look at the departures. Rodri, albeit after one season, and Griezmann are gone. Huge. Big blows, but when you analyse the defence, you get really, really concerned. Felipe Luis, Juan Fran, Diego Godin are all gone. That's 630-plus appearances combined of experience. So this is what needs to happen at the back, and this is where I'm concerned about Atleti not being close. Jimenez must become the leader back there, and Trippier must settle quickly. Lodi, the Brazilian, must settle quickly as well. Hermoso, who's been brought in to partner with Jimenez. I have... the same concerns, well, maybe not quite the same, but similar concerns for Real Madrid at the back. I don't like Madrid at the back either, but I think Madrid have a more potent attack than Atleti. So, which wins out here? The two new, not new defences, the old defence of Real Madrid, however that's constituted, the new defence of Atleti, that's what's going to dictate it for me. I still think Atleti's attack is good. Madrid's, if they can configure it right, is better. Short answer, I think Madrid might reclaim that second spot.
You and I are not quite on the same page here, and I find that interesting. I'll start with Real Madrid on this one, because right now, if the question is who can pose a greater challenge to Barcelona, I hate to say this, but at this very moment, while we sit here, August 13th, it's an unanswerable question, because there's this Neymar bomb just sitting out there where, like, is he going to go back to Barcelona, who apparently have this offer on the table for him of 100 million euros? Is he going to go to Real Madrid, who have been, it seems like, most seriously linked? Is he going to stay? So it's hard to know, because for everything we say about him negatively, he is still a force if he goes to a team like Barcelona or Real Madrid, a force enough that he could possibly swing the balance of power, at least close the gap, and certainly get Real Madrid past Atletico Madrid. So until we know what happens with him, it's kind of difficult to really say. The thing with Real Madrid that I can't determine at this moment is whether or not stability is a good thing or a bad thing. Because honestly, if you look at them last year to this year, it's pretty much going to be the same team, just add in Eden Hazard, which is obviously a good thing. So, like, it's a good thing adding him in, but what about the rest of this team that was kind of, by their standards, unsuccessful last season? Like, is it good to be a stable force in that way? Like, could we look at it and just say, well, it took them a year to learn how to play without Ronaldo. Now maybe they've done that.
But what has that got to do with, like, one of the major problems was the center midfield, where you had Kroos in there and people were strolling by him? And that's not my words. That's Graham Hunter's words, Andrew. Varane and Ramos. I mean, is that really a partnership? I like Varane. I think he's a brilliant player. A really good center back. He did not have a good season last season. And,
no.
And Sergio Ramos is in major decline.
Not the player that he once was, which is why I'm even asking. Usually, that's what I'm saying. Stability is usually a good thing. And when you're talking about names like this, you would think typically it is. Modric.
Marcella at fullback again?
But, like, I don't know if stability was the right thing for Real Madrid here. So, I'm honestly not sure.
Yeah, so... I've just gone with the Hazard
And I've gone with Modric, and I've gone with the potential of that attack is going to carry them a little bit further than Atleti. I'm not even confident in any of these words.
So then, well, then there's the Atletico Madrid side, which you mentioned some of this huge losses. Griezmann, Lucas Hernandez, Rodri. That's 270 million euros worth of talent out the door. Like that, and that does not even factor in Diego Godin, who was left on a free. So like that, those are massive players to have left the club all in one transfer window. But like you said, João Felix is probably in the conversation for being among the biggest signings by any club in Europe this past summer.
And has had a great preseason getting people excited, but is but a boy.
He certainly is. But it's not just him coming in. You mentioned Mario Hermoso. Hector Herrera came in, the Mexican international. Marcos Llorente comes over from Real Madrid, which could be really important in like a defensive midfield role. But there are problems. Diego Costa is starting out the year injured. So primary goal-scoring responsibility is going to be on Alvaro Morata and Nikolo Kalinic. Like, I don't know what to think of those guys, especially Morata, who has had great moments in La Liga, but then came to England and, like, was terrible, and now goes back to Atletico Madrid.
Can he shoulder the burden and do all the things that Diego Costa does?
So it's funny, because your questions were more in defense. I actually still feel good about them in defense, because part of that is just Diego Simeone. I'm just going to trust him to coach these players up to know how to defend.
To have a man walking around with Trippier on, like, translating everything.
But, well, there's that. But also, too, like, you know, I don't know. It's Versalco, Savage, Jimenez. Like, there are still good, like, truly good world-class players that he has back there in defense. I feel good about their midfield. You know, Koke, Lamar. To me, like, it's their attack that I worry about. I just, like, Diego Costa was not great last season. Missed games for injury, missed games for suspension. He's starting off the year injured again. Like, if he's their primary goal-scoring threat, I know they have Saul as well, who's an excellent player, but I don't know. I was going to say
goals from midfield may have to bridge that gap, and Saul can definitely come up with them.
And look, the great X factor here is João Felix, because if he winds up being this, like, Ronaldo-esque player where he can just kind of take a game upon himself and win it, then that changes everything. But until we see it, it's hard to predict that a player that young going to a new club is going to be able to do that right away. So it's kind of a weak answer here. I honestly, right now, don't know. Between Real Madrid and Atletico Madrid. I'll say maybe Atletico, but I think for those two, it could come down to the final day, and I don't know that it'll matter, because I think Barcelona are still significantly enough ahead. One more question for you here for La Liga. Any particular bit of business from the summer that you liked or disliked?
Breaking all the rules here.
All right.
I'm going to talk about a bit of business that is interesting. I don't know if it breaks all the rules. I found it curious. So Bilbao have inked a new contract with Iñaki Williams. Just 9 years, Andrew. A 9-year contract. He's 25. He'll be there until 2028. We don't believe he will be, but his deal includes a 135 million euro release clause.
Which sounds like a lot now, but in 6 years, like, with where we're headed.
But like, he's 25 and he had 13 league goals last season. That's not blowing me away. So what do they know? Or what have they seen from him that thinks there's someone coming in and they're gonna spend big? We gotta insure our guy. 9 years. Now, obviously they have their unique kind of curious way of signing players. They have to be Basque.
That was what I was gonna bring up. Maybe it's not about him. Maybe it's the fact that, like, there's kind of like a dramatic drop in the talent pool that they're able to choose from after him.
Right.
So they have no choice. We've got to hang on to this guy.
Because of our policies.
Yeah.
And he is Basque born, so there we go. Another one that's curious for me, and people are going to say, well, this is a bit boring, JJ, but it's not really. Denis Suarez, back at his former youth side, Celta Vigo, and this is an extremely interesting transfer. Can he finally blossom? How will he link up with Diego Aspas? Is he going there because he has seen how Aspas has thrived after that kind of horror spell at Liverpool? Could he have just ended up leaving Barca and Arsenal in exchange for a relegation battle in Galicia? You know, all those questions. Like, is he literally going from a bad situation into an even worse one? And Diego Lainez, new manager for him, first full season at Betis, struggled since his move, but is now under a new manager in Ruby, and he's just 19. Like, is this where he pushes on and becomes the brightest youth talent in a side that's pretty exciting last season if they fell away a bit. And obviously, I think you want to talk about Fekir.
Yeah, I was going to mention him as a signing that I do like. I think Real Betis always knew that it was going to be difficult to keep Giovanni Lo Celso. So they preemptively struck and they got Fekir from Lyon on a bargain. That's the big thing here, value for money. I mean, a year ago, he was valued, you'll know this as well as anyone, he was valued at $65 million. But Betis is getting him for $22 million. Now, there are add-ons to that, so you know we'll see if that rises to 35 or so, which is potentially what it gets to. But even at $35 million for Nabil Fekir, it's probably a good deal. He's not a sure thing. His stats took a dip last season for Lyon, and there's always going to be those physical concerns after he tore his ACL in the 15-16 season. But there is a best-case scenario here with this guy where he's among the best attacking players in the league. And for a club like Real Betis to have one of those players on their roster, I would think for them that's a good thing. So this was a good value for money buy. Sometimes in value for money, it's never going to be necessarily a sure thing, but you got to take those risks, and there's high upside for this. So, yeah, full applause to Real Betis for that bit of business. That's about it for our look at La Liga. Of course, we'll talk about it all throughout the season, as you know. But do you even want to make predictions? We kind of both said that we think Barcelona are going to win.
I think it's going to be Barcelona. I hate doing this to Atleti because I think you made a more compelling case, but I'm just concerned about how quickly you can reconstitute that backline. So I'm going to say Barcelona, Real Madrid, Atleti. Atleti and Real Madrid maybe vying close for that second spot.
That's honestly how I feel about it too. All right, we continue now. Mailbag time at CO Soccer Pod and caughtoffsidepod@gmail.com and caughtoffsideespn on Instagram.
Let's begin with Help a Fan.
Oh.
Mara entered Help a Fan and ended up with Arsenal. She asked for a redo because of her boyfriend's objections to Arsenal. We couldn't comply with that request.
Somebody asked me for a
redo. And you did, and yeah, you were kind enough to. I wouldn't do it because everything pointed towards Arsenal. She was a Green Bay Packers fan. There was a lot of history going on. This was her boyfriend's understated response.
All right, Chris, how are you feeling about this revelation that I'm now an Arsenal fan?
I don't want to, like, over-dramatize this, but this might be the worst thing to happen to me. Like, I genuinely, like, in no way did I think this is going to happen, and I feel actually dead inside, so.
All right, great.
Is he a Spurs fan?
I think he's a Man United fan, which he's harkening back to the rivalry days. I don't get it. But he was
crestfallen
by this. By the way, thank you to everyone who really received their teams with aplomb, even if I did give you Brighton or Sheffield United.
Did you really?
I gave those out, yep.
One guy
couldn't stop talking about seafood, and all I could think about was Brighton and the seagulls and by the sea, and he ended up with Brighton. His whole life was in seafood. He even mentioned Jaws. Seaside, Brighton. It's happening. Thanks to everyone. By the way, if your DMs weren't open on Instagram, that's why you didn't get a team. If there's anybody, I'm going to be a generous guy, email me if there's anybody who genuinely feels a grievance.
Oh, you DM'd people. I just went straight on Twitter.
No, on Instagram, I had to DM them.
Oh, so yeah. I'm not familiar with Instagram. I asked you for our password. You don't even know it. How do you get on?
Like, because I've logged in originally and it just stays on your phone. So anyway, but if you have a genuine grievance, get in touch with me. Clever Jeremy, why do you think it is that Solskjaer seems to be under more pressure than Lampard? They both have legend status at their clubs and pretty much the same managing credentials. Almost everyone has United picked to finish below Chelsea this year, yet if yesterday's result went the other way with the same scoreline, we'd be talking about Ole sacked by Christmas, would we not? Is my United bias carrying me off course? Well, I think...
Yes, I think it is, honestly. I think that you're kind of blinding yourself a little bit to what we saw over the last couple months of last season. Like, yeah. Frank Lampard is a brand new manager, so there's always going to be a grace period for him to come into this league and kind of figure it out.
Ollie's gone through that.
Right. Solskjaer, United, what was it? They won 2 of their last 12. Like, that was a really, really bad spell for a manager that a lot of people questioned the appointment of in the first place. So it's only natural that he has a little bit more history, not much, but enough of a history over Lampard managing in this league that, you know, questions will be asked of him sooner than a guy who's only managed one game in the Premier League.
Lampard has a transfer ban to deal with as well, and the major complaint and grumble out of United was discontent that they haven't made enough transfers. By the way, at this juncture, we should just quickly mention that the defence, the new-look Man United defence. Quick thoughts from the weekend?
good.
I thought Wan-Bissaka was very, very good going forward. I think people need to go back and watch the Emerson chance, how himself and Lindelof completely got their wires crossed. He ended up in on top of Lindelof, and suddenly Emerson's got this chance to just belt it off the bar. I think there's teething there. I thought Maguire just absolutely bullied Tammy Abraham, and I thought he brought a steal back there. So if I'm a United fan, I'm very happy about that. I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, I thought they were a little bit helped by Chelsea. And,
sure.
And the woodwork.
But we've said that. And I don't think
There was the one play I wanted to mention before. Granted, young player, but like Mount had the opportunity kind of like sort of on the diagonal from De Gea.
Yes.
Got caught between two minds. He should have just taken the shot. Instead, he played kind of a careless ball back across the box, and that was the chance evaporated. Just take the shot.
Yeah. Max Garner in Melbourne. G'day, boys. Just a quick one for your mailbag. Not sure if you've had this question before. We actually haven't. But is there a player that you would have thought would have been a world beater if it weren't for their injuries? As an Aussie, the obvious one for me is Harry Kewell. Oh, yeah. Injuries put a huge setback on his time at Liverpool, even though he did start a Champions League final and they actually won it when he came off. Well, that's not fair. Steve Finnan came off too. Would love to know if anyone crosses your mind. I know the one you're going to say straight away.
I have two here.
Can I predict them?
Sure.
Ledley King.
Yes.
And Sir Michael of Owen.
No, but yes. Like, that is absolutely one. No, I was going to say, now world class is strong, but I was going to look at your team. Daniel Sturridge.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Just remember, like, he was part of the Sturridge and Suarez. Like, he was among the greatest strike partnerships in that time.
They scored 700 goals that season. It was so good.
Yeah, like, it's easy to forget now because he kind of has receded into what we now think of him. It's hard to remember that it wasn't that long ago where he was... I mean, how highly thought of was he? And injuries have just totally ruined his career.
Yeah.
Sad. Ledley King, you forget, he had to retire at like 30, 31 years old. He basically stopped training.
He couldn't train, yeah. Paul McGrath was the same. Paul McGrath would never train at Aston Villa in his latter years. They had to keep him ready for whatever they could get out of him.
Yeah.
Those are some that come to mind as well. Actually, tweet us if you can think of other ones. Finally, it's Kevin, 24/7. I really want to know what you think about this at CO Soccer Pod. So this is Alexi Lalas responding on Fox's broadcast of MLS to Zlatan Ibrahimovic's criticism of the playoff system.
You can be a team that just coasts through. Yes, you can. But the great teams are able to do it in the regular season and then translate it to the postseason. Zlatan, you didn't make the playoffs last year, so it's evidently not that easy. Make the playoffs, my friend, then go win MLS Cup, and then complain all you want about whatever MLS is or isn't on or off the field.
I don't know if I would have said it quite the way he does, but I actually kind of agree with him.
First of all, Zlatan's asked these questions, then he responds. I agree with him to the point, I'm on record. There are really average teams that get into the playoffs.
True.
And you can be bad all the way through the season, suddenly you have a spurt, and away you go. That's the system, though. That's the league you're in. Like, why are you complaining? You had a choice to come here, you know? That's the other side. It works both ways. I can hold two thoughts in my mind with Zlatan on this. I agree. And at the same time, roll your sleeves up. Get on with it.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, I don't know. This is not, to me, this is not like befitting of Zlatan's character in that, like, where's confident Zlatan who comes out and answers that question by saying, I dominate the regular season, I dominate the postseason? Like, where's that Zlatan? This preemptive whining about the system, this doesn't feel like the Zlatan that we know here. So, like, go, like, if you're a great player and you believe you're on a great team, go win it.
Don't
whine about it. I don't know. Who wants to hear that?
Go to somewhere that doesn't have this system. I'm sure he had his pick, so.
Yeah. That's it.
It's truncated.
One with the abbreviated mailbag.
Keep them coming. The mailbag will usually be longer, but we kind of, this is going to be a monstrous podcast.
Yeah, before we get to what to watch for, JJ, now I'll be totally honest and upfront with you right now. There's a lot of Champions League results today that wound up being a lot more interesting than I may have ever been expecting going in. I did not see these games. So all I can look at is the results and say, oh, wow. Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
Go on.
Ajax barely got past PAOK Salonika. 3-2 on the was the final on the day on the second leg, 5-4 on aggregate. A couple goals from Dusan Tadic and another one from Tagliafico in the 79th minute, which proved to be massive. Salonika did get one in stoppage time to make it, I'm sure, like shades of the last time Ajax was in the Champions League. I'm sure the fans were terrified, but they do get through, so good for them. But then some other results, JJ. Cluj shocks Celtic.
Yes. Didn't see this one. Didn't see this result coming. The Romanians have knocked Celtic out, and this is just... To say that this has upset Celtic fans is... I can't even tell you. There was reinforcements made at centre-back for Celtic, and that centre-back did not play tonight. His selections have been questioned massively, he being Neil Lennon, the manager. This is the worst possible start to the season for them. This is a team who prides itself on its European history and believes it should be in the Champions League every season. An incredible shock. That is a seismic shock tonight.
Unbelievable. Yeah, they lose on aggregate 5-4, 4-3 on the night. They give up four goals at home to Cluj.
3-2 up at one point.
Amazing. They gave up a goal in the 80th and then another one in the 97th, which proved to be decisive. That is shocking. But maybe not, well, I don't know. We could debate, I guess, which one is more shocking. But Porto are out of the Champions League. 3-3 on aggregate, but Krasnodar go through on away goals. It was 3-0 in this game in the 34th minute. Porto clearly sleepwalking through this. Porto had come in with a 1-0 lead after the first leg. They did wake up and get it back to 3-3 on aggregate, scoring in the 57th and 77th. So they gave themselves basically 15 minutes at the end to frantically get that last goal to put themselves through, but it doesn't arrive. And Porto are out of the Champions League before it even really begins. That, I don't know, that one, Celtic, those are the two that really shocked me. And I guess the fact that Ajax, it was even close.
I'm just looking at the Celtic team here. Neil Lennon played three at the back tonight. And I'm just looking at the Celtic 11 that played tonight, Andrew, and... We are miles away from when they were beating United 1-0 or even beating Barcelona. This is such a fall off for
them. Unbelievable. Yeah. So those are really the ones that most stood out to me in the Champions League qualifying. We get to what to watch for now, JJ, the UEFA Super Cup.
Ugh.
Wednesday.
Go on.
Wednesday at 3, Liverpool and Chelsea.
Yeah.
Is this one now kind of playing off of the email that we just got about Lampard? Not to say that anything really matters.
Don't get battered, though.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Is like, this is a game that ordinarily I don't think we would pay all that much attention to. It's kind of a glorified European Community Shield. But, I don't know, on the heels of a 4-0 loss, if he gets flattened again by another good side in England...
Chelsea fans are just going to want to see signs that they're... tighter, that they're not... they leak goals all preseason, so hopefully he can find a way to get that out the system. Hopefully Kante got enough minutes at the weekend to maybe give him the full 90. I don't know.
It's certainly another chance for Frank Lampard to infuriate American fans. So we'll have to see if
he
that
best
happens.
Start Pulisic.
The Campeones Cup, JJ.
Huh?
It's Wednesday at 8 o'clock, Atlanta United FC and Club America.
Good.
Yeah. I do want to mention that... Are we being too dismissive of this? Should we care more?
The account for the Campeones Cup has like 3,000 followers. Do you not think it should not be good? Do you not think it should have more?
Honestly, I don't. And that speaks to what I kind of think of it.
I think if you want to talk about something interesting out of this, Guillermo Ochoa arrived in Mexico City as he's... joining Club America, and he's been told he'll have to earn a spot, according to Miguel Herrera, the manager. But the airport scenes were quite something. Welcomed like a returning god.
That is interesting. Joseph Martinez, JJ, is who I wanted to mention. He can't stop scoring. He scored twice over the weekend, extends his record goal scoring streak now to 10 straight games. So he has rediscovered his form. I guess we should mention, Frank de Boer made some comments to The Guardian about the issue of equal pay. He said, I think for me it's ridiculous when asked about the plans for equal pay. It's the same like tennis. If there are watching for the World Cup final, 500 million people or something like that, and 100 million for a women's final, that's a difference. So it's not the same. And of course they have to be paid what they deserve to earn and not less, just what they really deserve. If it's just as popular as the men, then they will get it. But because the income and the advertising will go into that, but it's not like that. So why do they have to earn the same? I think it's ridiculous. I don't understand that. I don't have a ton to say about this other than I feel like he is speaking just totally off the cuff here without really knowing what he's talking about.
I don't feel as if he has invested much time in the equal pay and the pay disparity conversation or looked at the figures or maybe even questioned why there is such a gap between the men and the women. Historically, the lack of opportunity for women in sport, none of that. I think he has just, as I think it was Andrew Dass said on Twitter, dipped his toe in.
Yeah, that's kind of what it feels like. And but he didn't just dip it in, though. Like, you make comments like this.
It's the term ridiculous was not very well thought out by him. And honestly, I don't want to crush him for it because it sounds as it is off the top of his head. But I would say you are quite within your rights to say, well, I don't know enough about this subject and I won't talk. Or I'd like to learn more about it and I think equality is always good. Why don't you give Champions League magazine answer? This is what, of course the women should be paid equally. In an equal world, that's what I'd strive for. But right now, I don't know enough about this subject to go any further.
You've gotten very good at that, I gotta say. I could easily see that being a thing that happened on Champions League magazine.
Yeah, that would be, it's a perfect answer.
Let's see, MLS JJ Wednesday, lots of midweek action. Alert everyone, midweek action. Wednesday, 10:30, LA Galaxy and FC Dallas. Saturday, we'll skip to Saturday now, 8 o'clock p.m., Chicago Fire and Philadelphia Union. One note here with the Union, I feel like there's been this Field of Dreams sentiment around the Union, like the whole, if you build it, they will come.
Okay.
Like this idea of there's no buzz in Philadelphia. People are wondering, oh, I guess soccer just can't make it in this city. No, that was never the case. They've been so bad for so long. If you win, they will come. And that is what's happening. The atmosphere there for that game was unbelievable.
Oh, yeah?
The other night. It's what you envision. You know, Philadelphia crowds get behind their teams, but you got to give them something. 2-1 win for the Union over Houston. And it was, like I said, it was great. I saw this tweet from Matthew DeGeorge. I wanted to mention it. It's one of those tweets that when I read it, I was like, that can't be true. But then you think about it. At 13-7-6, the Union are 6 games over .500. For the first time in franchise history.
Oh my God!
I mean, that tells you what you're dealing with here. Like 6 games over .500. Yeah, this has been a great season for them, but like they've been around long enough where it shouldn't be historic.
They've been around a decade next year.
Like so, wow. that
I'm glad
you,
they got that over the that they got that off their back.
So that tells you exactly like why crowds have maybe been slow to take to this team because they've just been so bad or average for so long. So
the Philadelphia Union have been trash since 2010.
Saturday, 10 o'clock, Real Salt Lake and LAFC and JJ Mike Petke's tumultuous tenure has come to an end. He was fired by Real Salt Lake.
Yes, he was. They decided that in the end, the things he was supposed to have said to the referee, including the slur, were unacceptable.
Yeah. Yeah, he was supposed to have come back from what was a 2-week suspension on Monday, but obviously they changed their mind at the end of that suspension and just fired him outright. This is from Alex Vejar's article in the Salt Lake Tribune. After RSL lost to Tigres, Petke was seen yelling at referees vociferously after receiving a red card. It was later revealed that Petke had repeatedly hurled a homophobic slur to the referees, both on the field and in the tunnel of Rio Tinto Stadium shortly afterward. He also confronted the referees in the tunnel with a handwritten sign that displayed the slur. Like, so as if he didn't get his message across when he was yelling it to him, he needed to make sure they knew what he was saying, and he actually took the trouble of writing it down and showing it to them. Like
this guy, covered this guy before. Petke is considered to be a good coach. His coaching is now so much more in the background, and his behavior is much more to the forefront now.
I watched the video. It was uncomfortable the way he talked to those referees.
During his time in charge, Real Salt Lake, 36 wins, 35 losses, 14 draws.
I mean, it's like he was outperforming his bad behavior.
That's the thing. I hate to say this because nobody should be allowed to get away with saying the kinds of things that he's screaming at and writing down and showing to these referees. But like, we live in the real world where certain people can get away with more than others. So if you're going to act that way, you damn well better be unbelievable at your job.
That's for sure.
And that, like, you have a record like that, it kind of makes it easy for Real Salt Lake to do what is probably the right thing. One note on LAFC, Carlos Vela scored over the weekend and became the highest scoring Mexican player in MLS history, passing... You're not going to get it.
He played at Chicago Fire. Blanco.
No, Eric Torres.
Okay.
Sunday, 10 o'clock, Portland Timbers and Atlanta United FC. JJ, take this moment to tell us about your time at Providence Park.
Wonderful, wonderful stadium. You come in at the arched side with the wonderful ivy on the walls, suggesting the history of the stadium, that it's been there a long time, since the 1920s, and was a baseball ground before that. And it's just the new stand with the old side. The whole ambiance is brilliant. The Timbers Army are excellent fans. The fans themselves are so engaged. It is the only show in town right now because basketball is in the off season. But even still, this place is... they're so committed to their team. They love their team. And it's a really good ground to watch soccer in. And I could drop that ground in the Bundesliga. I could drop that ground anywhere. And you would not know that this was soccer in America. Which is...
wow, what a demeaning...
That's not what I mean. Not actually what I mean.
Even for little old America,
I mean,
who would have ever thought people would care here?
Look, it has an authenticity about it, definitely. It has that. It has a certain Portlandia vibe, there's no question. But it has, I don't know, it feels real. I said off air to you about some stadiums, some of the newer stadiums leave me cold.
No, I get it, yeah.
This is so organic and original, just like them. And they're great. Absolutely great. I had a wonderful time.
I've always been of the opinion that you could pick up Gillette Stadium and drop it anywhere in the world and not even know where you were.
I will say one thing. They have diners. You can dine along the sideline, behind the advertising hoarding, on the sideline. No.
Is there a cheese room?
There is no cheese room that
I
know of.
It's not a real ground.
By the way, I hate that. And I tweeted out, imagine if Eric Cantona had to jump through some early evening diners to kung fu kick Matthew Simmons in 95. Imagine.
That's great. By the way, you say the Timbers are the only show in town. You'd be wrong, my friend. Saturday at 10:30, Portland Thorns in the NWSL take on Washington. Portland beat North Carolina over the weekend.
Oh,
front of an NWSL record 25,218 fans.
Oh yeah, when I said it's the only show in town, I should have said the stadium, the fans are the only show in town. The Thorns game was I've never seen so many NWSL jerseys in a city in all my life. People walking around wearing them. So, I did not mean that to be demeaning. Thank you for trying to get me in trouble with everyone.
It's what I do. That game, Portland over North Carolina, of course, a rematch of last year's final, which North Carolina won 3-0. Did you see the highlights of this, or did you watch this game? Because
I did.
Say that there was a little bit of luck involved in Portland getting this win.
We'll get to that. We're going to get to that. All I will say is Portland scored two of the most rubbish goals in the history of football.
They all count the same.
They really do. Luck was on their side.
It certainly was. La Liga, like we mentioned, Friday, 3 o'clock, it all kicks off. Athletic Bilbao and Barcelona. And then Saturday, 11 a.m., Celta Vigo, Real Madrid. EPL, a couple good ones this weekend, JJ. Saturday, 12:30, Manchester City and Tottenham. Spurs go back to the scene of the crime. The famous VAR decision that changed my life. And Sunday, 11:30 a.m., Chelsea and Leicester City.
City playing here against Chelsea.
Can I just say...
extremely excited for this one. I'm all a white.
Don't be like that. He was excellent, I thought, over the weekend. He
is excellent.
Call of the Ndombele goal gave me goosebumps.
I do impressions of everyone. Calm down there.
It's hurtful the way you talk about him. One thing I wanted to say about Chelsea and Leicester City, I don't remember what website this was on. I should give credit or lack of credit to where it's due. The transfer window is closed. Why am I still seeing a transfer rumor appear somewhere saying Chelsea considering swoop in for Ben Chilwell? No, it's over. Can't we stop now? We had enough of this. The transfer rumors are done. Let's at least wait until the next window opens in January. My God. All right, JJ, we do this now.
Red card.
You want to go first?
Yeah, Rob Dawson, ESPN FC with this one. Manchester City have avoided a transfer ban despite admitting breaking FIFA rules on signing young players, but were fined £315,000 sterling.
Manchester City?
Where will they find the money?
That's insulting.
After breaching rules on the transfer and regulation of foreign players under the age of 18, there was a risk they could be punished with a transfer ban after Chelsea were banned from registering new players for two windows after a similar breach of FIFA regulations. Chelsea cannot sign new players until the end of January 2020. Instead, City have been hit with a fine after admitting breaking the rules. A statement by the club released on Tuesday said, Manchester City FC can confirm that today it has received a reprimand and a CHF £370,000 fine following the decision of the FIFA Disciplinary Committee concerning the international transfer of players under the age of 18, particularly in relation to their trial periods and participation in friendly games. The club accepts responsibility for the breaches, which arose as a which result of misinterpretation of the regulations in question.
Oh, you were so close.
All of the breaches occurred before December 2016 when guidance on the interpretation of the provisions was issued, since which date Manchester City has been fully compliant. The club regards highly and shares FIFA's determination to ensure the protection of minors in football and has cooperated fully with the investigation, which has been transparent and evidence-based at all times.
Interesting.
Very interesting. I don't know why they don't get a ban. Chelsea get a ban, they don't get a
ban.
Well,
is it a little bit of what you said at the end there, that they were doing this before the rules were clear on that?
All of the breaches occurred before December 2016 when guidance on the interpretation of the provisions was issued, since which date Manchester City have been fully compliant.
So when did Chelsea commit their violations?
I don't know.
All right. One day we'll understand more about how all this works, but that day all is I know not is, today.
How are they going to survive with such a fine?
Sad. Sad. My red card, JJ, goes to Mason Toy, the 20-year-old from Minnesota United FC, spit on Reggie Cannon over the weekend and will miss tomorrow's match against Colorado and probably more as we await MLS's decision on a lengthier suspension. I actually should have Googled that. I wonder if something was handed down sometime today. I don't know. Maybe it was. Toy did post a statement on Instagram saying, I want to apologize to MNUFC, our fans, the MLS, and most importantly, Reggie Cannon and FC Dallas. My actions last night were distasteful and inexcusable, and there's no place for it in the game of soccer. Although it may not look like it, I had no intention of spitting on any player. No, it certainly did not look like it. That looked like a heat-seeking missile. However, I did spit, and it did hit a player, and because of that, I will have to face the repercussions. It was a really stupid mistake, and it's one that I will most definitely learn from. Again, I'm extremely sorry for my actions and hope for your forgiveness. One small silver lining to this, and this is really small, but whatever. You did see, I thought, some like real leadership with Minnesota when Darwin Quintero and Lawrence Olam, two of Toy's teammates, came right over to him.
What are you doing?
And they went after their teammate, Toy, the same way that they would have gone after an opposing player. They were clearly mad at him for doing what he did, which is what leaders should do. Look, ultimately, Mason Toy, he's 20 years old. This shouldn't be an incident that defines his career. That's not fair. But at 20 years old, you do know right from wrong. So he should willingly accept whatever punishment the league hands down on this, because like I said, I'm sure a lengthier suspension will be coming, and he should probably just kind of take his medicine on this one. Let's see, we continue now.
Caught Offside's Man of the Match.
What do you got?
Woman of the Match, Adriana Franch, goalkeeper Portland Thorns. The 2018 NWSL Goalkeeper of the Year put in what can only be described as a heroic performance to deny the Courage 3 points and secure her side the win at Providence Park. On Sunday, Portland scored two of the most calamitous goals you will ever see, and the Courage will be absolutely disgusted with themselves. They dominated this game, went one up through Crystal Dunn, had keeper Stephanie Labbe throw in one, I don't know, it was off a cross and she pammed it behind herself into the net, and then concede on 82nd minutes from an Ersig own goal, which was again another calamity. The Courage had 20 shots, 11 on target, as opposed to 10 shots and 4 on target from the home team. Franch was the difference, Andrew. She made 3 saves that qualify in the world-class category, and the 28-year-old is the sole reason from a Portland perspective that they sit on top of the NWSL this week and not the Courage. That's how tight it is. Had a hard time picking my favourite save, but I would say the 62nd minute save to deny Williams 1v1 from the 6-yard line was my pick.
And Williams has a chance again! French keeping it out of the goal.
Behind the defensive back line, Bum done this time. Williams takes a touch inside. French coming up. Huge to save this one because it was nothing between Williams and that goal besides AD Franch.
Happy to put my neck on the line here and say she should be the US women's national team number one.
Oh my. This is
under the new manager. Andrew, she saved one in the first half, which was it was between these two for which goal I picked was my favorite. She pulled one out of the top corner from Williams. Like, it's going in, and her athleticism, top hand, left hand, tips it over the bar. And she made another save from Williams from a header. Brilliant performance. And the best goalkeeper in the league by miles. Why isn't she... If she's the NWSL goalkeeper of the year, how is she not the starting goalkeeper for the US Women's National Team?
I mean, Lindsay Horan was MVP. She wasn't starting in midfield. I don't know.
Good point.
My man of the match, JJ, Borussia Dortmund. They're a club known for raising young talent, and it appears as though the next generation is starting to identify itself. 14-year-old Youssoufa Moukoko scored 6 goals in his debut for the under-19s. 14-year-old for the under-19s. This is on the heels of a season in which he scored 50 goals in 28 matches for the under-17s, but I'm kind of burying the lead here because the story for me is one that American fans will care more about, and that is Gio Reyna, son of Claudio Reyna. He scored in the first minute of his competitive debut and then provided an assist in the second minute. Lars Ricken, Dortmund's youth coach, described Reyna as one of the world's best midfield talents in his age group. He's 16 years old. It feels like he's in the right place, JJ, to be brought along the right way, and hopefully we're witnessing the infancy of the next truly promising American star.
Oh, absolutely. And, I mean, such is our appetite for young players and monitoring them and everything that we have videos floating around from preseason of Reyna just being... really quite good.
Yeah, I mean, he was playing in Dortmund's exhibition games over the summer and looking really good doing it.
We should mention
super young.
Yeah, we should mention not so super young, but making his, I assume it would be his Champions League debut tonight was Sergiño Dest.
Yeah,
who came on for Ajax. So keep an eye there. We've got some talent.
Yeah,
hopefully we.
It's all
coming together, man. don't be worried about Pulisic. We got. Young players coming on. He's going to be a veteran. He'll be a veteran at 25. And Reyna will be in the team alongside him. And this will all be just the weekend will just be a bad dream.
That 2026 World Cup. Let's make that our goal. Pulisic, at that point, let's see, he's 20 years old. That World Cup will be in the winter. So will he have... let's see, what year is it?
No, 2026 won't.
Oh, right. 2022 is the one that's in the winter.
Yeah, come on.
Right. So 2026, he'll be 27, right in the thick of his prime. Reyna will be a 23-year-old. Adams, McKinney, they'll all be in that one, home soil. That's the one.
Well, we're winning it, obviously.
That's the one to identify.
Can you zap us for the arrogance quickly?
I forgot. We're terrible. We probably won't even qualify at home. All right, that's about it. We'll be back, of course, next
week.
What a podcast. Yeah, there's a lot going on there. Certainly a lot. Enjoy the Premier League this weekend. Enjoy the start of La Liga, MLS. I think I saw that there's Carabao Cup that was happening.
Oh, can I just check the score?
I think I saw Sunderland won today. So there's just like...
How did Leeds and Salford finish? Hold on one second.
You're actually concerned.
Hold on. I am, because Leeds United... I want to see do well. I want them back in the Premier League.
Well, what does the Carabao Cup have to do with that?
Well, no, it's an indicator of form. Yeah, they beat Salford City, who are the second richest club in Manchester. It's a bit of a Manchester joke there. Salford lost 3-0, which is good because they have too much money. There we go.
All right. I love when we end on a humorous...
It's owned by the class of 92 and the owner of Valencia as well. So
to you I say...
Take you later, fun boy.
See you later, man.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.